This is Marilyn Scott. I'm director of the McGill School of Environment, and I'm delighted to be co-chairing this session this afternoon. I hope you agree with me that we've really been had three very, very intriguing and stimulating presentations to end off the day. As you come to the microphones with your questions, I'd just like to mention, an idea that's occurred to me as I've listened to the three presentations in sequence. And what really struck me in the first two was the potential for competition. When we're talking about water resources, it's easy in a conference like this to focus on water as it ties to food production, irrigation needs. Yet both of the first two speakers highlighted domestic water use, industrial water use, and other needs for water, setting up the potential for conflict or competition for the demand for water itself. And so coming in, and actually one additional point, is the consequences or the potential for competition between those that are impoverished, who have minimal, very, very limited food, and the potential for them to have even worsening conditions as the more rich elements of the society put greater demands on the resources that are available for food and water. Yet in the final presentation, it was really interesting to see bringing these ideas together, looking at a more of a systems approach, and paying attention at the same time to the environment. So I was really encouraged to see how, at least from my perspective coming in from the environment side, this all seems to be very hopeful. So I'd like to open to questions and encourage you to come up to the mics, please, Will. We're going to stop right at 5:30, so I will be watching the time, and we'll stop the lineup so we don't have people sort of waiting and then not able to ask their questions. So, yes, could you please go ahead?
Yeah, could the panel indicate how they handle water pollution and, more specifically, how they deal with wastewater, both commercial and residential?
I would not concentrate on Indian case while answering this question. It was brought out even in the previous session on the use of poor quality water and wastewater. From ICID exam, we have quite a few examples from ICID. And it is possible. In fact, agriculture is one sector which uses water that which other sectors cannot simply use. When it comes to green water use and rain-fed cultivation, the soil moisture is not so easily recoverable for any other usages. Similarly, the wastewater, in a way it is a sort of an asset if properly treated and reused because of the possibility of using the nutrients. And on this, quite a few cases have been developed, even a sort of how to not only deficit irrigation, but mix with fresh water some of the treated poor quality water. And a lot is being done in this, the drainage water. It also came up in respect of the use of poor quality water in Canada. I think Raghavan was trying to answer that part of it. So globally, a lot of opportunities exist for reuse of wastewater in agriculture. It has been found acceptable. Safeguards and safety standards are being evolved. And I think quite a few you have been, and India is slightly behind China in the reuse of wastewater in irrigated agriculture. But then it is happening, though not. What is required is ensuring enough safeguards in the use of poor quality water in irrigated agriculture. A lot has to be done, but it is happening.
Dr. Gao, Dr. Campos, would you like to add anything to that?
Yes, thank you. So in China, we have a national standard for water quality for irrigation. So for the reuse of wastewater, mainly for domestic sewage, after treatment, meet the standard for irrigation. Certain kind of crop, but we never use sewage or treated water for irrigate vegetables. And also in China recent years, we introduced the technology improve the no-point pollution by increasing fertilizer application efficiency and also control other chemical, agricultural chemicals. Try to control the surface water pollution. Thank you.
Dr. Campos, would you like to add anything?
Well, in our case, we work with small-scale farmers, small and medium enterprises, in a context of watershed management. And in that respect, what we aim is implementing, promoting more sustainable land management practices that would include, for example, protecting recharge areas in a landscape, in a watershed. We would work with the local partners, the stakeholders, to identify the critical areas where actions have to be focused. Usually the watershed is larger than the resources available to, and they have to be focused on critical areas. And one of those critical areas, for example, is water recharge areas. And how this has been done is by creating different financial mechanisms, and one example is what we have created with environmental funds managed by local governments, where they would actually provide incentives, different kind of incentives to farmers to protect those critical areas. Payment for ecosystem services, for example, there is a very interesting example in Honduras, in the Cupana area, where in a pilot scale, but then it was implemented through a tariff in the water use. The mayor of that area was convinced that they needed to include in the tariff of the water the cost of managing those critical areas. And in that way, we are then promoting more water-friendly and land and crop management practices.
Thank you. Would you like to go ahead, please?
Hi, my name is Audrey Yank. I'm a bioresource engineering student at McGill University and also a Canadian youth delegate to the next UN Climate Change Conference. So my question is addressed more to the two first speakers. We've heard about the large dam projects that are currently going on in China and India. And I would like to know if these are really sustainable for a long term, considering the future impacts of climate change, for example, evaporation. And my second question is if there could be a shift more from the supply management side to more the demand management side, and if there could be more a shift also from large scale to smaller scale, especially for answering the needs of smallholders in irrigation. Thank you.
Thank you. It is a very, very interesting question, whether it should be supply-side management or demand-side management, as well as why should one opt for large-scale solutions as compared to small-scale collective solution and dams in particular. One important thing that came up right from the beginning is the extra water that is required to assure water security, not only for food security, but also the demands from other sectoral things, including environmental preservation. So I did mention about in the presentation the industrial drinking water and energy, as well as other demand. Other includes the environmental flows and all. If we try to look at demand-side management, there is a limit up to which that one could think of recovering. So, for instance, in the Indian case, the present levels of diversions, both surface as well as groundwater abstraction, is of the order of about 600 billion cubic meter. So even with better demand-side management and ensuring a sort of 20% reduction or recovery, it would mean recovering about 100 billion cubic meter of water. But when we require for the future needs something of the order of 3 to 4 times, the supply side has to also be looked into so that you don't get into any difficulty. So this is one thing that we should try to acknowledge. The pressure is from population, increased needs, increased nutritional demand to be met with, increased living standards for ensuring fresh quality water for drinking, and also industrial growth so that there is enhanced livelihood thing. So when you want all these things to happen, not only demand-side management, but also supply-side management is an essential requisite, especially in economies where development to the full scale has not taken place. I did show the amount of days of water in a basin that has been stored in different river systems in India. And what you noticed was in one case hardly about 2 days water. And if you see Nile, it is of the order of 3 years, 3 into 365 days. So one has to see the settings before trying to really see whether what is achievable from that.
Thank you. So in China, I think we work on both demand management, water demand management, and supply management. So for the demand management, as I mentioned, we introduce water saving technology, not only in irrigation sector, but also in industry and domestic sector. But only with water saving project, we cannot solve all the problem. We still have increasing demand. So we need increasing water supply capacity. As I mentioned, in China, precipitation is very uneven, just focus on 4 months. So without storage capacity, increasing storage capacity, we cannot solve the demand increasing problem. But we put the priority on safe water and then on further development of storage. For the newly developed storage dam, we combine irrigation and hydropower generation, and also flood control, coordinate these three benefits. For the management of a large system, I think we have in China, we have a specialized agent with good technical assistance manage the large scale system. To the tertiary canal, usually managed by water user association, smallholders, collective of smallholders. So scales very different from small scale to medium and to large scale system. So we manage by involvement of different stakeholders, try to improve the whole system. Thank you.
Thank you. Go ahead, please.
My name is Nuthan Kumar. I'm a student at the University of Ottawa in International Development, and I'm doing my major research project on rural water research management in India, and I'm looking specifically at institutional arrangements. So my question is specifically for Dr. Gopal Krishnan. Building on my colleague's previous question about supply versus demand management, I'm still hearing a gap in, I feel that there's still a gap in your presentation on institutional arrangements, because from the literature, or from the growing body of literature, shows that the Indian government has succeeded greatly in providing access and increasing coverage of water supply to rural regions as well as urban, but has not paid attention to quality. It has failed also to, or at least from the literature, it seems to have failed to consult with local communities, take them into consideration, as we've heard from both the presentation on China as well as Dr. Campos's presentation about involving local stakeholders. I still feel that I've not heard that from the Indian presentation. So where do you feel that India's government policy is right now on community-based or participatory-based research and collective action?
It's an excellent question. The point is, the Indian government is concentrating on the demand side management, and in fact it is in the new National Water Mission document to achieve about 20% enhanced efficiency. So coupled with the answer that I gave for the previous question, and yours. One is, we can't afford to mismanage the water resources as it is happening, and it is well taken note of, and corrective measures are on. At the same time, we do not want that the successive generations try to enjoy less than what we do because of the population, even much more than the climate change. The pressure on countries like India is the increase in population. If you see the global population, which is going to, say, perhaps reach 8 to 9 billion, somewhere in between in 2050, where from that actual increase occurs. The highest increase is going to be from India, because China could take measures to stabilize, and it is anticipated by 2025, Indian population would exceed the Chinese population. And given that situation, any planner has to see from now how best to address that future needs, and especially when it comes to food. We did talk about how much it takes for even 1 ton of grain production. And how do we get it? Can we simply manage it by the demand side management? And if the answer is uncertain or no, one has to think of also seeing the supply side management, and supply side is awfully beneath the requirement. And in fact, apart from this, there is a lot of energy needs, and given the fact that hydro energy is one of the things that would reduce also the carbon emission, one has to see collectively. And that's how some of these projects are getting contemplated. We cannot move the people from region, water scarce region, to water rich region, because that type of migration also creates problem. And how do you counter it? Why not see how best to do that, either by virtual water, or we are doing everything for the green water augmentation by water conservation and so on, but the ability to create that much storage is limited, and it has to be blue water. And also a lot of efforts are on increasing the virtual water storage almost in every province, trying to create the grain storage of a substantial, at least 1 million tons in each, 10 million tons in each one of the provinces in the country. And it implies that behind that you have created a storage reservoir because of the virtual water that goes into it. So all these things put together can probably ensure India, which can at least survive, if not go to the main thing is population, and of course climate change on the top of it, which is trying to also introduce new dimension problems for the rain-fed agriculture. And if we want to do that irrigated agriculture of some of the existing rain-fed, you have to see how to get water for that. It came out in the earlier presentation by Bart about the intensification of irrigation, 3 times growing of rice, and the land is the same, but you need water. And how do you get water? At a time when there is no rainfall. That is storage. And this is how you have to see it in a holistic manner.
Not small challenges. Yes, please go ahead.
Thank you. Question for China. How does the government manage food demand? Because you said that's one of the activities the government does. A question to both India and China. Why, given the economic status and the relative water scarcity, has there been almost no adoption of drip and sprinkler to date? And the third question to the presentation from Cartier, what is an ideal, what management mechanism, governance system is needed to outscale this watershed management model that you proposed? Because given that these hydrologic boundaries are generally not recognized, you know, by the national governments, or are just so different from the admin boundaries that are usually where we do find the governance mechanisms. I can see that it can be done with the support of an institute like Cartier to build the platforms, etc. But there's the question of sustainability, and more importantly, how can you outscale it without having every time someone coming in from the outside? Thanks.
Dr. Campos, do you want to start maybe, and then we'll come back?
China.
We'll answer the third question first, and then...
Okay, so some of the experiences where this is happening, and it's the role of, for example, talking about model forests, there is an international network of model forests that where there are about 50 model forests around the world, and the whole purpose is to share experiences from different regions in the world, and I think that's a very good way of sharing those experiences about those governance structures. And in that network, there is representation from the model forests, but also from the national governments where those model forests are. And that's one way. Regarding model forests, where lots of watersheds are managed within those model forests. And in our case, we are also bringing this into this debate, the policy dialogue. And, for example, in Nicaragua, they have created a legislation where the whole country is divided into watersheds, and they have actually supported the creation of basin organizations, and this is one way of doing it. There is also, I learned recently that there is a North American network of basin organizations, and this is also a way. In Costa Rica, for example, about 10 years ago, a basin organization was created by law. That was the first time, and now they are discussing a law, a national law, to actually promote more basin organizations to strengthen this kind of governance structure. So these are some of the ways that this could be scaled out. But I think very important is that to understand that these social and institutional arrangements are key if we want a watershed management to be effective.
Okay, for the food management by government, I think in China, we have the quota for the food security. Currently, the quota is about 400 kilogram per person per year. That's if we can produce 400 kilogram grape per person per year, we think we get the food security. But this figure will be increased to 430 by 2020 due to the change of diet. As I mentioned, now people eat more meat. 400 kilogram per person per year, not just for table consumption, but also for the other processing industry, including meat industry. Recently, some research also find due to the sharp change in diet, some disease happen. So the government try to figure out the reason and introduce the healthy diet. At least the first measure. Second is, China is so big. Previously, in South China, we produce more grain. In North China, we have insufficient grain. So we transport grain from South China to North China. But now it's changed. Due to the quick development of industry in South China, they don't want to grow rice and other crops. They develop industry. So currently, we produce more grain in North China and transfer grain from North China to South China. But the problem is, as I mentioned, water is South China. So we have to transfer water from South China to North China and then produce food, transfer food from North China to South China. Yeah, thank you.
Food management is essentially in India. One is trying to be as far as possible self-sufficient instead of importing. And when it becomes impossible, then opt for the importation of the food grains. The problem was one of affordability, as I was mentioning in the last slide. There are sufficient number of rural, even urban poor, what we call below poverty line. And in such cases, there has to be a sort of a deliberate intervention by the government. And I showed in the last slide one of the provinces which is trying to distribute grains for those who are below poverty line virtually for no cost. It is what we call rupee 1 per kilogram of rice. Rupee 1 is 1/45th of a dollar. You can see that it is almost negligible. And even after that, there was enough in the bins. So there was food, but it hasn't reached those who deserve. So there was food insecurity. And that's where how to go about distribution to the deserving without leakages came up. And it was also thought of moving the people to the grain to lift as much as they want in case they are below poverty line. There can be very many interventions of different sorts. Overcoming this, it itself compels action within the country. In other words, why India is not in a position to import grains even if it is at a cheaper price? The agriculture is the main anchor for the rural poor for their livelihood. So come what may, in order to ensure that as much is produced locally with sufficient intervention, sufficient subsidy is that of the government. It includes even microfinance through government banks and others. And in extraordinary cases, especially in the rain-fed agriculture, where the farmer doesn't get the anticipated yield and is about to commit suicide, there are quite a few such cases, the government in a big way waives off the entire loan, and it amounted to as much as about 6.7 lakh crores or 0.67 billion Indian rupees 2 years back. So all types of interventions are being undertaken. While one side you try to see the supply side augmentation, even contemplating long distance water transfer, trying to also see all the interests are protected, that is environment and others, besides the provincial interests, those who give and those who take, how to negotiate and how to bring it legally sustainable. So that's a great challenge, and that's why the great challenge for ensuring water security, for water, for food security, is something that India has to face in the coming 2 or 3 decades. The transfer which has happened from South to North China was a little bit easier, but given our political system, it is not that easy. There are many who raise eyebrows. Sometimes the media propagates, if you manage your demand side better, everything would be well. There we have to be cautious, because if it is not a correct statement, we will be leaving behind a system for our successive generation which is inferior to what we enjoyed. So the efforts of some of the people to also think of the supply side, despite arguments that it is unnecessary, is essentially to safeguard successive generation. My children, my grandchildren, my great-grandchildren, they are going to suffer. It can be argued in any manner, and even in the demand side management, if efficiency improvement by 20% is not going to be that easy. It is just not mathematics. First 5, 10 easier. Next 5% and the last 5% at margin, it asks for enormous effort, including governance, participatory things and so on, other interventions apart, engineering, sprinklers and things like that. So it is a big challenge. And while it can happen, no government can think that all will be well. If they want to sustain, they take care of the supply side too.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Would you like to go ahead, please?
Thank you. My name is Lana McGuire, and I'm a student at UBC in Vancouver, University of British Columbia. And I'd like to thank you all for your addresses, but my question is for Dr. Campos. I really appreciated the perspective that you offered, and I felt like it was more of a grassroots initiative in the countries that you work in. And I was just wondering if you could give us an illustration of one of the situations or one of the projects that you worked on in Latin America that you could share with us. Yeah.
Thank you very much. Yes, we are implementing a project that we call Adaptive Co-Management of Watersheds, and this has been implemented regionally in Central America, particularly in 2 countries, very poor countries, the poorest countries in the region, Nicaragua and Honduras. And in those two countries, we chose 4 watersheds to work with the local actors. We call it like lab watersheds, where we actually implemented this approach of adaptive co-management of watersheds, strengthening the institutions. And that was a project that started after the Mitch hurricane. But the first phase, it was a more conventional watershed management approach. After 3 years, we questioned ourselves and we questioned the whole paradigm. That we ran a master's program in watershed management. And after assessing the impacts of watershed management projects in Central America, we were really concerned about sustainable impacts. And that's when we decided that we discovered that there was a need for a change in the paradigm. And in that respect, we then started working mainly on developing what we call a watershed committees. And in each of those four watersheds, and since 2004, so 6 years now, and it's been very interesting to hear from one of the directors of that committee saying that that approach of it's been the co-management approach, as they call it. Now they use it for many other things, health issues, for example, because it's bringing the different stakeholders to discuss, and they will then find develop proposals for addressing the issues that comes, like food production or health, education, water management. And that's in the Copan area in Honduras, which is water is very important. Also in very close to the capital of Honduras, in Tegucigalpa, Valle de Angeles, where it's very interesting. One example is that they were concerned about the contamination of water in Valle de Angeles, and this is a touristic area, and protecting the recharge area from cattle, from visitors going there, they reduced the levels of contamination, and water became drinkable again using this environmental fund. And now they are using these funds they got from the donor who funded SIDA from Sweden, who funded that project. They are leveraging those funds to find more national funds or other donors' funds. So the idea is to develop sustainable financing mechanisms. In Nicaragua, also two other watersheds. And a very interesting example, I'm just picking some ideas, and it's that they organized by themselves. It was a sporadic organization of the local population. They opposed the use of fire, of burning, and the logging, illegal logging in the area. They organized a referendum, and the referendum was so massive in favor of reducing those practices that finally the local government passed a regulation to control that. So that project is still going on, and the idea, we were expanding this concept of co-management. It's now introduced in our master's program, and it's been implemented through other programs we have in the region in Central America and outside Central America.
Terrific examples. Thank you. I think this... go ahead, please.
Thank you. You almost said this is the last question.
I almost said, and so, then I remembered that we still do have a few more minutes.
So. Yes, sir. All right. Thank you. I think this is excellent, and I think we also need to thank the panel. But also the chairs have done a wonderful job of keeping everything strict so we don't waste time here. I'm very impressed that we have still so many people in the audience. It's almost 5:30, and we had gone on from 8 o'clock, and still it's more than half full. So if not the teachers at McGill have threatened the students to stay behind, I must say I'm quite impressed. Now, I have some questions for the panel. And I realize that we have had two presentations of two of the biggest countries in the world and one from one of the smallest countries in the world. So the contrasts are big, but also the possibilities of doing different things is substantial here. And that is probably why they sort of cross-fertilize each other. To India, a very interesting presentation. I'm a nutritionist myself, so I learn a lot. But what we see in nutrition is that India suffers from discrimination. Is there anything in your thinking about discrimination that you bring into your science and thinking when you discuss the supply side and the demand side? So that is one very concrete question. We heard from Costa Rica about learning, social learning, you know, learning from local people. Is there such a process in India that you actually learn from local farmers? What do they say in terms of their own needs that will have an impact on the policy? To China, very fascinating to see how a big country can manage so much. But I would have liked to see the model you put up, the food security, and then you had only water. So I would have liked to see the nutrition, the dietary part there as well. So that was also taken into consideration in your own discussion further on. Have you seen at any of the challenges of what Tim Jones asked earlier today about the varieties that you produce? Have you considered other varieties that maybe need less water than the actual varieties you use now? Then to Dr. Campos, I was very impressed by all the presentations, but also by yours. It reminded me of much of how I was stimulated once by ecological systems. So I have a few questions on that. I also started to use resilience as a word. But you are using both resilience and sustainability. Now, words are very important for academics. So I wonder, why are you using both terms? What is resilience giving to those you speak to in terms of meaning compared to sustainability, which is a very important distinction? I also wondered, you had a figure with three dimensions on, and one was the value chain. Why are you using the value chain and not the food chain as a concept? Value chain is a very commercial thing and very sort of market-oriented, so it might be the right thing to do. I'm not quite sure. You used the term watershed a lot. Have you considered to link this with the term food sheds? That term has been used by many, and it seems to fit very well with your model. And then a question to the whole panel. Have any of you read General Comment 15 to the Economic, Social and Cultural Rights, the right to water?
Okay, so let's take off. Would you like to start, please? Can you remember the questions?
Yeah, I am really grateful. He flagged so many issues, and essentially in respect of what I spoke, the Indian case, he was wondering as to what India could do, especially for the discriminated group, and that's a very, very good question. And we had this unusual situation, and when for over centuries certain groups, certain communities were discriminated, and how to lift them to come at least at par with the rest of the groups. This is a great effort. Right from 60s, we have all sort of protection for those who stood discriminated and who stand discriminated. In fact, the Indian Constitution was framed by one coming from out of that group, one who was some of those who have studied Indian historic things would know, Dr. Ambedkar. So the question of discrimination has been, it stood attacked right from Indian independence, but the social thinking, it took time. But as of now, there had been considerable improvement, and in order to protect the underprivileged, be it on whatever basis, wherever they live, and what the government has done, even for those who are in the poverty situations in rural areas, assuming that they are usefully engaged in their farming and other activities for about 160 days, there are two seasons when these crops are grown, both planting, then harvesting and upkeep. 200 idle days, or I won't call it unemployment allowance, it is a sort of national rural employment guarantee scheme. They have to work if they want to. They would be getting compensated at a level which is comparable to what the government would pay for anybody at its lowest tier. So that way they are having an assured income, and this also helps to interlink the useful engagement of those idle labor in activities like rural roads, desilting of the canals, and it is mostly rural focused. And that way they are trying to see that the underprivileged are helped. There are special programs for tribal area development, and also even when the projects are taken up, an added regional disparity weightage is given, and for those areas, the center fully funds. More or less, it is the public taxation fund that goes, and the country very gladly accepts. So it is a process that would take a little bit more time, but it is happening.
Perfect. Dr. Gao.
Yeah. Thank you. I think it's a very good question. Actually, in China, in recent 10 years, we focus very much on improvement of a variety with less water. We have a good research. He owed, I think, a prize from the United Nations. He worked on improvement of a new variety of rice with less water, extend his variety, extend in large area. I think currently we still very highlight on this issue. I think if you're interested, think you can cooperate with scientists in China on this research program. And for the ecosystem, I mentioned water saving irrigation. In China, recent 10 years, we highlight water saving irrigation in irrigation scheme. But recent 2 years, we find some problem in some system, save too much water and find the ecosystem problem. Usually at the tail of the system, there's a lake or wetland. That's very important for the system. With water saving project in some areas, there are no water in the lake and create a lot of eco problem. So how much water we should save is also a new thinking. We sort of rethink it again. In some system, we cannot save too much water. And also for the right to water, I think it's also a good question. So I have not mentioned the drinking water. In China, 10 years ago, we have 300 million people without access to clean drinking water. But recent 10 years, government input a lot, try to solve this problem. I'm happy to tell you by the end of 2013, we can solve this problem. All the people in the rural area can access clean drinking water. Thank you.
And Dr. Kappels.
Yes, regarding resilience and sustainable development, and we use it as a complement. We believe that resilience is a condition, and will be even more a condition for sustainable development, for lasting development, because the world will be confronted each year more with increasing pressures, climate change, all these challenges that we are facing. And a key condition would be the capacity of social and ecological systems to recover from those pressures. In that respect, particularly the social and ecological systems are key, but having a systems approach, using the livelihoods approach, the community capitals, the assets, we believe is important. And we've seen disasters in different countries, in different regions, and we can see how countries with better social institutions and more healthier ecosystems, they can recover faster than other countries who don't have those conditions. The second point regarding value chain and food chain, it's because we are in our context. We are working with other products that are not only food, like fiber, like timber, non-timber forest products. In that respect, we use the value chain concept that, probably in the context of producing food, the food chain would be more focused. And watershed and food shed, first, again, it's we are using that a concept considering that water is a central element in that we are managing, very much related different needs in the landscape. And I have to confess that I don't know about the food shed concept, that I would be willing to learn more. And thank you very much.
Okay, well, thank you. Thank you all for the questions. Thank you very much to the panel, or to the speakers, for their presentations and also for their responses to the questions. I just wanted to mention three things before we close this afternoon. There was reference this morning by Eugene Terry to Transform Africa. There's a document that has been printed and is available for anyone that is interested on the tables outside, so please help yourself. The survey has already been mentioned, so I'll just remind you that there's a blue sheet on the table. If you would take a few minutes to fill that in for today, there will be another one provided for tomorrow. And finally, we will now have a cocktail reception. There is a bar outside. Food. I'm seeing food that has been provided on the sides. And in addition, we have posters on both sides of the room. The students that have prepared the posters will be standing by their posters and very anxious to talk about them with you. So I'd encourage you to mingle. You can get a drink from a ticket that's in the back of your name tag. And so please enjoy yourselves, and we'll see you all back here tomorrow. Yes. So thank you, everyone.